Everybody dies. The subject of death and dying becomes more and more relevant the older we get. Just looking around, I know that I will probably die before most of the people in this room. And that's if we're all lucky. The human body has an enormous capacity for survival and healing. There are all sorts of repair systems and backups, redundancies and substitutions and workarounds. But there comes a point in our lives when those systems start to get maxed out. That's when the decline becomes really noticeable. Illness and injury are no longer things that we just get over and go on from. There are residual effects that don't get better. Even without any specific incidents, there is a decline, a loss of flexibility, strength, and stamina. All the visits to the gym, all the yoga, all those dietary precautions will not stop this progress. We come now to the last chapter of one of the most extraordinary lives that has ever been lived. And yet, it is ordinary in the highest sense. It is the life of a human being who fully realized his humanity. The story of the Buddha's last days and of his passing are well known. It's not giving away any plot surprises to say that he quietly entered his final meditation, surrounded by disciples, while the earth and heavens mourned his passing. Socrates died quietly while talking with friends. Philip Kaplaroshi died peacefully, sitting in his wheelchair in the garden of the Rochester Zen Center, surrounded by disciples chanting and singing. Now that's nice, but we can't count on it. There are plane crashes, automobile accidents, wars, horrific forms of cancer, Alzheimer's, ALS, multiple sclerosis, and so on. So what lesson do we take from the Buddha's passing or the passing of Philip Kaplow or Robert Aitken? Sherwin Nuland writes, "The greatest dignity to be found in death is the dignity of the life that preceded it." The dignity of our lives. What Robert Aitken Roshi called 100% combustion every moment. The Buddha lived his life fully and completely in the moment. Therefore, he was able to die his death fully and completely in the moment. And what does he do as the end approaches? He continues. He continues to teach, to exhort, to admonish, to encourage. Nothing really changes. Why? Because he is thoroughly aware of who and what he is. Buddha lives the life of Buddha. He lives it wholly and completely, moment to moment to moment. There is nothing to change. No, oh my God, I'm going to die. What do I do now? All the Buddha did was to see clearly what was right in front of him and respond appropriately. It really is that simple. Can we do that? Can we live our lives fully in this moment? Can we live so that when that final illness, condition, fading becomes more and more evident, we can simply acknowledge the fact and continue to live our lives? Or if death comes suddenly with little or no warning, can we be completely with that? Or as Roshi said earlier, can we just get on the bus? If you are living a life in which you find yourself saying, well, someday I will, or later on I'll, when I retire I'll, if I just finish this project, I'll, then that life is not real. It is a provisional life. The real life is a life of practice, of awareness, of awakeness in this moment. It is to live a life of no regrets, no if-onlys, or why didn't I do this, or why did I do that. Don't accumulate a bucket list. The great sutras and discourses are often very long and involved, with hundreds of lines of verse and metaphors that are over the top. But the Buddha's last teachings are spare and direct, pretty much the same as his initial teachings. Impermanence, the Eightfold Path, self-reliance, the precepts. He had already taught everything that was necessary to reach the goal. Now his primary concern is to impress on all his followers the absolute necessity of continuing to practice courageously without flinching. There's no contemporary account of the life and passing of the Buddha. The first complete biography was written some 300 years later by the poet monk Asvaghosa. A written account of the Parinirvana is found in the Mahaparinibbana Sutta, in a collection of long discourses from the Pali. These various stories are the basis of the Parinirvana ceremonies that we've held here at the center. And I suspect that most folks here have read Ralph Martin's rendition in The Hungry Tigers. But let us follow the last footsteps of the Master and see where they take us. In the last retreat, the Buddha goes to Vaisali, to a grove that's been donated to him and the Sangha by a beautiful courtesan named Amra. At the beginning of the retreat, the Buddha once more admonishes his disciples. During this retreat, let all of you dwell mindful and self-possessed. Mindful and self-possessed. If we sit, walk, work, eat mindfully and self-possessed, we are manifesting what Robert Aitken called the deportment of Buddhas, enlightenment itself. Sitting here right now, are we mindful and self-possessed? Are we centered and still in this last day or so of Sesshin? At this point in Sesshin, those few thoughts that arise loom disproportionately large. They arise out of a quiet mind the way a solitary mountain rises from a flat plain. So don't be downhearted. Just continue. Now when the perfect one had thus begun to keep the rainy season, there came upon him a grievous dysentery. Strong pains racked him as though to end in death. But the perfect one, mindful and self-possessed, endured those pains unflinchingly and without complaining. I am seriously ill, thought Buddha, but it is not fitting that I should pass utterly away without notifying my supporters. without saying farewell to the Sangha. Suppose now that I were to hold down this sickness by an effort of will and stay on for a while by holding fast to the aggregates of conditioned existence. So the Buddha held down that sickness and stayed on, holding fast to the five factor groups of conditioned existence, the aggregates of corporality, feeling, perception, predisposing mental formations, and discriminative consciousness. All things done at the correct time, at the correct place. Appropriate responsiveness, says Yun Min. Obedience to the situation, says Thomas Merton. A time to be born and a time to die, says Ecclesiastes. For Buddha, the time has come not to die, not yet, but to bid for farewell. The sickness was subdued, but only for the moment. Ananda comes by. As has been mentioned, Ananda stands in for the seeker who is not yet realized. And he is fearful. Lord, I have seen the perfect one in health, and I have seen him in endurance. And though my body, Lord, became as if drugged, and my bearings were confused, though things were no longer clear to me because of the sickness of the perfect one, yet, Lord, I found some comfort in the thought that the perfect one surely will not pass utterly away until he has made some pronouncement concerning the Sangha. Buddha fixed his gaze upon his favorite disciple. What do you mean, Ananda? Does the Sangha expect that of me? Now, I have always proclaimed the truth to you without making any distinctions between exoteric and esoteric doctrine. The Tathagata is not like those teachers with a closed fist who keep back the best. If then anyone thinks that he should lead the Sangha, or that the Sangha depends on him, let him make some pronouncement. As for me, I am now a broken down old man, aged, far gone in years, kept going by medicine and spared pain only by mental concentration. I have reached the journey's end, Ananda. I have come to life's limit. My age has now turned 80 years. Even the Buddha has limits. We tell students here that if pain and sitting gets to the point where one can no longer practice effectively, then change your posture. Use a chair or whatever. But what about pain in life? The pain that becomes all-consuming. How long do we hang on? How many surgeries, organ transplants, dialysis treatments? The Buddha has reached a point where so much energy is spent just holding his body and life together, there is not enough to continue his work. Buddha has done what he has done and said what he has said. He has given it his all. Let that suffice. Buddha has complete faith in the Sangha. The Sangha can take care of itself, even if a lot of the members don't quite believe it. And so it has been from that day to this. As long as there are those who practice sincerely, Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha will continue. There follows a conversation with Ananda in which the Buddha informs him that if he chooses, the Buddha can remain on earth for the full remainder of the eon. He says to Ananda, whosoever has developed, cultivated, and fully understood meditation combined with concentration of will, energy, mind, and investigation, such a person, if he wishes, may remain on earth for the full eon, or for what is left of it. Even so broad a hint as this was dropped by the perfect one. Even though his meaning was clear and plain, yet Ananda was unable to understand what he meant. So he failed to beg Shakyamuni to stay on in his body. Three times the Buddha repeated his words, but Ananda still failed to grasp the Buddha's meaning. Ananda momentarily steps away from the Buddha, and Mara, the evil one, came into Shakyamuni's presence. "Now let the perfect one pass away," said Mara to Buddha's mind. "Now let the Buddha pass utterly away. Now is the proper time for the utter passing away of the perfect one. For thus it was spoken aforetime by the perfect one, 'O Mara, I shall not pass away until my monks are trained disciples, disciplined and confident, having won freedom, who have heard the teaching, who know the Dharma by heart, who fare on in accordance with the Dharma, who fare on with diligence, living in accordance with the Dharma, taking it as their very own teacher until they are able to proclaim, teach, establish, analyze, and make it clear, until they are able to refute any wrong view by right reasoning, until they are able to teach the Dharma that brings salvation with it. And now, ascetic," continued Mara, "all this has come to pass." And Mara goes on at even greater length about how all the goals that the Buddha had set for himself at the very beginning of his ministry have come to pass. "Therefore, now is the proper time for the complete, utter passing away of the perfect one." And the Buddha replies, "Do not become anxious, O Mara. The complete, utter passing away of the Tathagata shall take place in no long time. At the end of 3 months from now, the Tathagata shall pass utterly away." Now this is beginning to sound like a conversation between two old friends. How can that be? Mara, the deceiver, the voice of ego attachment, now counsels the Buddha to let go, which he intends to do anyway. Mara has reached accord with Buddha. No more temptations of endless joy and bliss. His three daughters are nowhere to be seen. Mara and Buddha are not separate. They never were. There is no deceiver. Everything is true. Everything is real. The voice of the discursive mind is as real as the vast silence of samadhi. For each of us, practice is to see our own personal Mara clearly. And thus Mara comes into accord with a great reality. Buddha makes the conscious decision to let it all go, to finally abandon the five skandhas that make up the psychophysical aspect of a human being, to let go of the world of time, space, and karma. There comes a point when it is just time. Quite a few years ago, one of our members, Frank Van West, quite a lovely man, was dying of leukemia. He decided to forego another session of chemotherapy because, as he said, it was time to get on with it. Here's a verse. "What causes life, unbounded or confined, this process of becoming, this the sage renounces. With inward calm and joy he breaks, as through a coat of mail, his own life's causes." the Buddha decided to get on with it. Now, since this is the Buddha, that very decision is accompanied by an earthquake. And Ananda, standing nearby, is terrified. He runs back to the Buddha, who explains that the cause of the earthquake is his monumental decision to let go of this life. And Ananda begs the Buddha to remain for the rest of this eon, for the gain of many, for the happiness of many, out of compassion for the world, for the joy, for the bliss, for the welfare of gods and men. It is natural to feel bereft, lost at the passing of such a guide. To grieve is natural, but so is it natural to move on, not to cling to a persona, to take the teachings to heart and eventually make them our own. And that, of course, means that they will change. The Buddhism taught by Shakyamuni is in many ways very different from our practice of Zen. Are we then heretics or blasphemers? Our ongoing practice is to see the essential message, not to get hung up on words spoken in a particular language by a particular person at a particular time. But Ananda, when he realizes for certain that the Buddha will pass away, rushes in to plead, "Stay just a little longer. Don't go quite yet. There's still stuff to do." "Enough, Ananda," replied the Buddha. "Do not ask that of the Tathagata. The time is now past, Ananda, for asking that of the Tathagata." Ananda asks a second and a third time, and the Buddha asks, "Then, Ananda, you believe that I am able to do that?" "Yes, Lord, I believe that the perfect one has this power." "That being the case, Ananda, yours is the fault and yours the transgression. Insofar as when so broad a hint was given, when such an illuminating remark was made by the Tathagata, you could not penetrate it so as to ask the Tathagata right then to remain on earth for the full eon. For if, Ananda, you had begged twice, the Tathagata might have consented. Therefore, Ananda, yours is the fault and yours is the transgression." Sounds a little harsh. Now, the Buddha said, "might have consented." So we don't really know what would have happened had Ananda acted. But that's not the point. The Buddha made his choice, and that choice was to let go of this life. Ananda did not understand nor speak, and I made my choice. All our lives are filled with choices. The Buddha, throughout his 40-year ministry, presented choices. Most of the Pali scripture is choices. We can choose good companions over evil ones. We can choose wise thinking over unwise thinking. Satisfaction over desire. Few desires over many desires. We can choose mindful awareness over lack of awareness. Diligence over negligence. We can choose aroused effort over laziness, and wisdom over fame, wealth, and the rest of it. We can strive for a controlled and disciplined mind or allow an uncontrolled and rampant mind. We can let go or we can cling. But not only do we often choose unwisely, we are so caught up in our stuff that we don't even realize there is a choice. The clear seeing of choice is a huge realization in itself, and it can be very uncomfortable. "I had no choice" is our excuse of choice. Will we always make the choice that is useful, skillful? Of course not. We just do the best we can. And then we accept the consequences. Ananda didn't see that he had a choice when the Buddha presented it to him. He said nothing. There's always a choice. There are choices that lead to peace, equanimity, joy for oneself and others. And they always seem like the more difficult ones. Our natural karmic bent is of momentary pleasures, ease, comfort, fulfillment of desires. No wonder we have so few members here. In Sesshin, we make that choice over and over and over, with every breath, every mu, every wan, every moment of sitting. We always have the choice to come back to the practice and rededicate ourselves. The Buddha comes to a village where he will take his last meal. Kunda the smith hears of the arrival of the Buddha and his monks, and he's bowled over. He runs to offer a meal to the Buddha and the assembly. To offer food or sustenance to a holy person is even today a widely accepted way of obtaining merit. Prostrating at the feet of the perfect one, Kunda said, "Let my Lord accept from my hands tomorrow's meal together with the assembly of monks." And the Buddha accepts. So Kunda is up early the next morning, chopping and grinding and cooking and doing all the things that happens during the work period, during Sesshin, including a quantity of mushrooms that were rather hastily picked out in the woods. When the perfect one arrived, he sat down, and immediately he perceived danger. At the risk of offending Kunda the smith, he thought, I must see to it the monks are not harmed. "Friend Kunda," said Buddha, "as to the dish of mushrooms you have prepared, serve me with that. As to the other food, serve the monks with that." Kunda served the food in accordance with the perfect one's instructions. The mushrooms were placed in the master's bowl, and those mushrooms were eaten by the master. After the perfect one had finished eating, he called to Kunda the smith and said, "Kunda, whatever remains of the dish of mushrooms, bury that in a hole dug in the ground, for I can see no one by whom that food can be digested, save only by the Tathagata." Kunda promptly went outside and buried the remainder of that dish of mushrooms in a hole dug in the ground. Not long after the perfect one had eaten, a severe sickness assailed him, and grievous pains, accompanied by a bloody flux, set in as if to end in death. But Shakyamuni remained calm and composed, enduring those excruciating pains without being overcome by them. Buddha has made the choice to let go of his existence in time and space. He chooses to eat what he knows is poisonous, and he accepts the consequences. He accepts the consequences, but only for himself. He exerts great care to see that no one else is harmed. Jesus accepted the scourging and the cross. Socrates accepted the cup of hemlock. This is genuine acceptance and forgiveness. We can only make such a decision for ourselves. We can never make it for others. But the Buddha's choice absolves Kunda. Kunda, after all, had no intent to harm the Buddha. And the Buddha knew full well what would happen. He has chosen. Now his only concern is that Kunda himself is not unfairly blamed. It may happen, Ananda, that someone will arouse remorse in Kunda that the Tathagata passed away after eating his last meal at his hands. Now, Ananda, any remorse in Kunda the smith should be dispelled by saying to him, "It is a gain to you, friend Kunda, that the Tathagata passed away after eating his last meal at your hands." Two meals are of like fruit and result, far exceeding any other meal. What are the two? That meal after eating which a Tathagata is awakened with supreme enlightenment, and that meal after eating which a Tathagata passes away and leaves no basis for rebirth. With such words should be dispelled any remorse which may arise in Kunda the smith. No, Kunda must not be hurt. The Buddha cannot be hurt. He cannot be threatened. If we truly understand our own impermanence, emptiness, non-abiding, then we cannot be threatened. We do not fear. And therefore, we do not blame. We do not become angry or vengeful. Thereafter, the Buddha traveled to the Sala Grove near Kushinara. There he asks Ananda to prepare a bed between the two of the sal trees. "For I am tired and I want to lie down." And the Buddha then laid himself down on his right side in the posture of a lion, with one foot resting upon the other, and he remained mindful and self-possessed. Throughout all the Buddha's life and teaching, there is a feeling of ritual, of ceremony, even from the very beginning. This may be partly due to the various translations, which seem a bit stilted from our postmodern perspective. But if we consider our liturgy and ceremonies here at the center, they are, among other things, just a matter of being mindful and self-possessed, mindful of body, speech, and mind. We take care of our actions, our speech, and our thoughts. In Buddha, everything is of a piece. He takes care. He lives and dies in full mindfulness, full awakeness. Now, the sala trees never lose their leaves entirely, and not until March does the new foliage appear. And not until April do the sala blossoms burst forth into full bloom. It was then, near the end of December. Then the perfect one addressed Ananda, saying, "See, Ananda, the twin sala trees are all one mass of bloom, with flowers out of season. They are scattering their blossoms all over the body of the Tathagata, covering him with their petals. Heavenly Mandarava flowers too, and heavenly sandalwood powder fall from the skies, and divine music and celestial choruses come drifting down. In this way, Ananda, all nature adores and worships the Tathagata." As with many towering religious or spiritual figures, the Buddha's birth, his enlightenment, and his passing are heralded by omens and events on a cosmic scale. The profound shaking of spiritual and psychological foundations is represented as bizarre, unnatural occurrences. As the song says, "The planets are paralyzed, the mountains are amazed. Fires fall from the sky, trees flower out of season, the very earth is shaken. Some gods weep, others rejoice. But of what real significance is all this? But it is not by all this, Ananda, that the Tathagata is rightly honored or venerated. The monk or nun, the devout layman or devout laywoman, who continually fulfills all the greater and lesser ethical duties, who conducts himself with propriety and in accordance with the precepts, it is he who rightly honors and venerates the Tathagata with the worthiest homage. How do we honor our teachers and ancestors? What is to be done after their passing? How do we practice? What shall we venerate? What shall we do with the remains? Should we build a magnificent tomb, light candles and hold vigils forever? Maybe something along the lines of a presidential library or Lenin's tomb. Fill it with artifacts, old newspaper clippings, DVDs. Do not worry yourselves with the body of the Tathagata. Do not hinder yourselves by performing the last rites for the Tathagata. Be zealous on your own behalf, I beseech you. Devote yourselves to your own good. Be earnest, enthusiastic, resolute. And some people say the Buddha has no passion. The last thing the Buddha wanted was to become the center of a personality cult that was hung up on the worship of a bunch of ashes. We honor our teachers in our sincere practice, our continuing work on ourselves. Are places of pilgrimage okay? We have this temple. We come here for renewal, rededication, solace in times of difficulty. A place of refuge is fine. It is wonderful that we have this temple. But it is not in itself enlightenment. Do not depend on it for enlightenment. It is not a nest. It is a springboard. Ananda goes off in tears, but the Buddha calls him back. Enough, Ananda, said Shakyamuni. Do not grieve nor weep. Have I not told you that in all things, even in those most near and dear to us, there is the element of transience, of separation, of otherness? How then can it be possible that what is born, what has come to be, what is of a nature to dissolve away, should fail to dissolve away? No such condition can exist. You have done well, Ananda. Apply yourself to effort, and you too shall soon attain nirvana. Ananda, be an island unto yourself. Be your own refuge with none other. Make the Dharma your island. Make the Dharma your refuge with none other. It may be, Ananda, that some of you will think, gone is the word of the Master. We have no teacher anymore. But you should not so regard it, Ananda, for the Dharma and discipline which I have set forth and laid down for you all, let them, after I am gone, be your teacher. I was going to comment on that, but I don't think there's a point. The Buddha asks the Sangha three times if any among them still has doubt or perplexity about the Buddha, Dharma, or Sangha. The monks remain silent. The Buddha declares that all have been genuinely converted. Each one is assured of attaining supreme, perfect enlightenment. The Tathagata has positive knowledge of the fact that this whole assembly of monks, that in this whole assembly of monks, there is not one monk who has any doubts as to these things. for even the most backward of all the many hundreds of monks has become genuinely converted, is no longer liable to be born in a state of suffering, and is destined to supreme and perfect enlightenment, to the bliss of nirvana. Even the most backward is destined to supreme and perfect enlightenment. Good news for the rest of us. Even the murderous Devadatta is destined to become a fully realized Buddha in a far distant kalpa. No one is irredeemable. No one. We hear tales of the dying who turn their face to the wall, withdraw into themselves in the last moments of life. Not so the Buddha. He doesn't have to. When you are everywhere, there is nowhere to turn, nothing to turn away from. When you are all beings, there is no one to turn towards or away from. You are Buddha. All are one with Buddha. The Buddha's voice is your voice. His words are your words. His life and death are your life and death. Buddha's no life and no death are your no life and no death. Now then, O monks, I remind you, subject to decay are all composite things. Strive diligently for liberation. He has come to the end of the way. Over the rivers of his many lives, his many deaths, beyond the sorrow of hell, beyond the great joy of heaven, by virtue of his purity. He has come to the end of the way. All that he had to do, he has done. And now, he is one.